Good evening. My name is Martin Lemlin, and this is CITR News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Hello, it's 5:03 on a beautiful Monday afternoon, and it's time for a full hour of independent news. Today we're going to be talking to Robert Mulvin, who's the president of the CUPW Vancouver, the union that represents postal workers. He's going to talk to us about Bill C-6 and what it means for the workers of Canada Post. We're also going to be talking to Gwen Barley about a report that the BC government recently put out about what they're going to do about keeping endangered species around for a little while. Rumana Manzoor, a UBC student, got her first dose of fresh news, a good news today in a while. We're going to speak to a friend of hers, Mohsen Sadiq, about what it means. And of course, Jesse Storm is going to be back with your weekly weather forecast. All this and so much more here on CITR News 101. But first, the headlines from FSRN.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Widespread protests erupted in Syria today. Media reports indicate that as many as a dozen people have been killed in clashes with security personnel. Today in Lithuania, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton issued a warning to the regime of President Bashar al-Assad, saying allowing one meeting of the opposition is not enough to prove there's a legitimate transition towards democracy.
The Syrian government is running out of time. They are either going to allow a serious political process that will include peaceful protests to take place throughout Syria and engage in a productive dialogue with members of the opposition and civil society, or they're going to continue to see increasingly organized resistance.
Government supporters also rallied today across Syria. The Freedom Flotilla 2, an international group of ships headed to Gaza in protest of Israeli policy there, has been slowed down by several incidents over the past 2 days. Organizers say two of their ships have had their propellers sabotaged. In addition, Greek authorities prohibited the flotilla ships from leaving Greece for Gaza, but members of the flotilla attempted the crossing anyway. The U.S.-based Audacity of Hope was stopped by the Greek Coast Guard today. A Canadian ship was also blocked from crossing, reports Haaretz. Thailand's major political parties drew large crowds today and final rallies ahead of Sunday's national election. As FSRN's Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok, the rallies also marked the end to 6 weeks of intense campaigns, with the governing Democrat Party lagging in opinion polls.
Under monsoon rains, thousands of supporters of Thailand's governing Democrat Party and opposition Pheu-Thai rallied, making a final push ahead of Sunday's general elections for a new 500-member parliament. Prime Minister and Democrat Party leader Apisit Wechachawa called for national unity and an end to political violence that has plagued Thailand over recent years. Democrat Party member Krysak Chunawon says a strong party base can be counted on going into Sunday's vote.
We do have a base support from the population who has been diehard Democrats. But what we need is a additional perhaps 15 or 20% from the undecided vote.
In opinion polls, the Democrats trail the Pua Thai Party, led by Yingluck Shinawat, sister of former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, who was overthrown in a coup in 2006. The Thai Election Commission has invited officials from 11 countries to observe Sunday's polls, according to the Thai news agency. The group includes several major regional democracies like Australia, Japan and India, as well as smaller powers like Bhutan, Malaysia and Bangladesh. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
More than 20,000 state workers in Minnesota started their holiday weekend a day early today, whether they wanted to or not. They're at home because state lawmakers could not pass a budget, forcing a government shutdown. For FSRN, Michelle Alamorati reports.
Failing to break the budget stalemate between Democratic Governor Mark Dayton and the Republican-controlled state legislature, the state government was forced to shut down as of midnight last night. This leaves Minnesotans without so-called non-essential state services. Jewish Community Action Director Vic Rosenthal says it's the poorest of residents that will be hit hardest by the shutdown.
Just regular, everyday people who have jobs that they depend on in order to pay for their mortgage or pay for the rent in their apartment. They're all going to be affected by this. It's just really sad to have to be doing this when it's a fairly simple problem to be fixed.
The Minnesota Department of Human Services says several grants for housing, food, and mental health services will also be unavailable during the shutdown. Lawmakers will resume efforts to close the budget gap after the holiday weekend. Michelle Alimurati, FSRN, Minneapolis.
Just weeks after the U.S. Supreme Court issued a decision demanding that California release thousands of inmates to alleviate chronic overcrowding, high-security prisoners at Pelican Bay State Prison in Crescent City say they plan to go on hunger strike. From California, FSRN's Hannah Vierkamp has more.
Between 50 and 100 prisoners at Pelican Bay State Prison's Security Housing Unit, known as the SHU, have organized a strike to protest conditions they say are inhumane. Jessica Watcott is with Bar None, a grassroots advocacy organization that has monitored human rights at Pelican Bay for 10 years.
I think that they're just extremely frustrated. They feel like they are at risk of dying in the SHU anyway, and so they feel like they have no other choice but to put their lives on the line to get people to pay attention to what's going on there.
The hunger strikers have issued 5 key demands through the advocacy group California Prison Focus. These include an end to group punishment and policies that coerce prisoners to inform on one another. They are also calling for adequate food, increased opportunities for education, and drastically reduced use of solitary confinement. Hannah Vierkamp, FSRN, Arcata, California.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Thank you very much to FSRN for those. A full newscast can be found at FSRN.org. You're listening to CITR News 101. I'm Martin Lemlin. It's time for local headlines. In provincial news, members of the BC Teachers Federation held a vote last Tuesday and almost unanimously decided to take job action if a collective agreement is not hashed out by September. BC teachers in the province have been trying to reach some sort of common ground in their contract since March, but they still aren't close to reaching an agreement. Now, the teachers say that their main issues are class sizes, adequate support levels, and of course, salaries. In response to the salaries, BC Minister of Education George Abbott said that the money for wage increases simply isn't there, and that the government's position, a strong position, he says, is that there will be no raises for those who work in the public sector at all. If September should come and the contract talks are still underway, the teachers won't necessarily strike. At this point, it looks like the plan is to continue teaching, but nothing more. They won't attend staff meetings or fill out forms or even do a formal report card. They will, however, provide parents with verbal reports on how their children are progressing. One of the biggest companies in the country has voluntarily paid a multi-million dollar settlement to the Competition Bureau of Canada. Bell Canada forked over $10 million for making misleading claims in their advertising campaign, it was announced last Tuesday. Now, this is the maximum penalty allowed under the Competition Act. The Bureau found that since December of 2007, Bell Canada has been charging more than advertised for many of its services, hiding the extra charges in fine print disclaimers. Now, although Bell has said it fundamentally disagrees with the Bureau's findings, it nonetheless agreed to pay the administrative amount of $10 million. The Federal Competition Bureau warned that if a price is offered to consumers, it has to be accurate. Including a fine print disclaimer doesn't give a company the right to advertise prices that are unavailable. Now, CITR News tried to get an interview with Bell Canada to set the record straight. Although they declined, their spokesman said that Bell has always complied with all applicable laws and regulations, and while they disagree with the Bureau, they consented to pay the penalty rather than grind through a lengthy and costly legal challenge. A motorcyclist tragically died at a rally in New York yesterday. The man, who I've decided should probably remain nameless, was a 55-year-old who joined over 500 other motorcyclists to protest anti-helmet laws. The group that organized the event, the Onondaga Chapter of American Bikers Aimed Towards Education, or ABATE, has held this ride on the July 4th long weekend to promote helmet freedom, to let bikers decide whether or not they should wear helmets. Now, sometime during the 50-kilometer run, the man lost control of his bike, went over the handlebars, and hit his head on the pavement, and died in the Syracuse hospital yesterday. It is likely that he would have survived the crash had he been wearing a helmet. Now, in a minute, we're going to be talking about the referendum and the mail that goes with it. You're listening to CITR News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM right here in Vancouver.
Are you interested in radio but not quite sure how to get involved? CITR is the place for you. We are a volunteer-driven campus and community radio station with a variety of volunteer opportunities. Want to become an on-air programmer? Learn about promotions? Maybe become a news or arts reporter? Come learn about all the ways you can become involved at CITR. Volunteer orientations are held on the first Monday of every month at 6:30 p.m. If the first Monday falls on a statutory holiday, the orientation moves to the second Monday. Visit citr.ca for more information.
Welcome back to CITR News 101. Just a friendly reminder that that orientation session is taking place tonight if you're interested in volunteering here at the station. Back to the headlines. The chief electoral officer has extended two dates in this summer's HST referendum. Craig James announced last week that he's extending the timeline of the HST referendum to compensate for Canada Post labor disputes. Now, so you now have until midnight on July 22nd to request a voting package, and until 4:30 on August 5th to return it. Most of the province can expect their voting packages to be delivered any time between now and July 7th. Now, if you haven't gotten one by then, which is Thursday, you should call Elections BC. The number is 1-800-661-8683, and you can request a voting package. Now, the package has to be returned by Elections BC by 4:30 on August 5th now. And, of course, postal workers were forced back to the job last week. After 2 weeks of rotating strikes, where postal workers stopped mail service in one Canadian city at a time, the Crown Corporation locked them out. And after 2 weeks of a nationwide halt on public mail, the government introduced Bill C-6, which forced workers back to their jobs without a collective agreement. Now, here to speak about how this bill is affecting the mailmen and women of Canada Post, I spoke to Robert Mulvin, the president of the Vancouver chapter of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers. Robert Mulvin is the president of CUPW, the union that's representing Canada Postal Workers. Thanks for joining us, Rob. How do the workers feel about essentially being forced back to work?
They're all pretty angry. They were out only on rotational strikes before. I guess you probably know the background. And up to the 14th, we hadn't even had a strike in the Vancouver local at that point. We hadn't gone out on the lines. And since being locked out, we kept hearing about how the damage was being done to the postal system. Well, there was not really any damage until that point when they turned around and locked the doors on us and created the loss to businesses, as they keep decrying. And everybody that is back at work now is faced with huge amounts of mail in the delivery area as well as in processing, and they're pretending it's all happy to have us back.
What does Bill C-6 offer in replacement of the collective agreement?
Well, the C-6 is like some of the worst legislation we've ever seen in, well, for sure, with CUPW and in labor in general. Like the back to work legislation that, you know, it backdated our collective agreement to February 1st, which is good, so it takes care of some of the loss of benefits and working conditions that we had suffered when we gave notice of the rotation. But ultimately, some of the aspects that hopefully are being challenged through the legal system now are the final offer process, which would have us put down our final offer, Canada Post put down their final offer, and then the arbitrator picks one. And this is, you know, extremely unusual, and hopefully is worthy of a challenge to the courts.
And you said that arbitration is going to take place in February of next year?
No, I'm sorry. That what I was referring to was the one aspect of the bill put our collective agreement, our present collective agreement, back in place until the new one is decided. So our collective agreement has been backdated to February 1st when the other one expired on the 31st of January. And it has in it a wage has been forced on us for the life of the contract for 4 years, and the wage is less than what Canada Post had on the table before they pulled out of negotiations. So, no, what I'm talking about is the way our contract is going to be instituted. We have got 90 days to come up with our final offer, as does Canada Post, and then the arbitrator simply chooses one. And it's a winner-take-all situation where, you know, there's no mediation or arbitration process. It's highly unusual.
So how do you decide on an arbitrator? Who gets to pick?
Yeah, we haven't heard that yet. But the government gets to pick the arbitrator. They get to work with Canada Post, you know, pretty much hand-in-hand, we believe, from some time. And I think it was really clinched when the Tories got a majority government. Locked the doors on us, and then they forced us back to work. It's an absurd situation.
Considering the way that Bill C-6 was introduced and that it offers less money than even Canada Post was willing to give, do you think that there's any hope for the workers that they'll gain anything out of this situation?
I think that one of the biggest gains has been sort of a public enlightenment, as well as our workforce seeing the NDP and other opposition speaking up in the House of Commons during that filibuster. I think it was a really good public display for those that, you know, never really heard the NDP side of things, and you know, some of our friends and neighbors and coworkers didn't really know where they were coming from until they heard them all speaking up, and it was an extraordinary time. I think that they've been emboldened by that, and hopefully so, because we're sort of at the beginning of something that looks pretty destructive for working class people in Canada.
I guess it is one of the initial moves that the Harper government has done with its majority government. What kind of a message does that send to the Canadian workers?
Well, that's what I feel that it's a real stranglehold on collective bargaining. It didn't give us any room for a final attempt to get some negotiating done with Canada Post, and with the way they were prepared, they had instituted the legislation for the Canadian auto workers at through the Air Canada strike. They had that all teed up, and luckily they brokered their own deal at the end of the day, and I think with us right behind that one, it's like a loud signal to labor that we've got a big fight ahead of us over the next few years, and I think with the help of some political parties that we're up against turning over the Tories in 4 years, but in the meantime, there's going to be a big fight in the labor movement in general towards some sort of all-out action, I hope, or well-orchestrated action as, you know, this starts to unfold into other public sector bargaining units, particularly.
Does the bill essentially abolish striking for Crown employees?
Well, that's what it feels like. That's what they've done to us. You know, we were in a rotational strike, but by the time they locked the doors, they quickly moved to legislation. They were waiting for us to go into an all-out strike, and we were only into rotating not even 2 weeks in, and they put the pressure on us by reducing delivery days and hoping that that would cause a reaction. It didn't, and that's when they locked the doors. I think it was a way of saying, okay, if we can't get you to do it that way, we're going to force you out the door, and and then force you back in afterwards to the tune of legislation. So it's just saying that we're not really interested in the collective bargaining process at all.
What's the best case scenario in the coming months for the union and the workers?
I think the best case scenario is that we get something underway in the court system and get a challenge to this bill before it's too late. I think that we've got 90 days to get something happening. I don't know that we can turn it around. I'm not sure of the legalities of that, but that would be the best thing. I mean, that's what, you know, my coworkers are saying already, is that it's good to hear that we're doing that right away. And that was indicated when they were, you know, asked to testify in the Senate, that you know, there were problems with the bill. So it was, you know, not just alluded to; it was directly part of the questioning. Like, where are we not looking at the legal aspects of this? Because it's not just syntactical errors in the bill itself, but problems with the legislation. So I hopefully something comes of that, and sooner than later.
What do you think is one of the biggest grievances with the bill for the workers?
I think the biggest one is that we still don't have a possibility of negotiating something. We're not being allowed to work with a mediator or the arbitrator and whoever is appointed. Ordinarily, you would have a chance to put whatever you had put on the table beforehand, and you know, your best offer in whatever different areas it was, but none of that mediation is going to be happening. It's one side will take all, and it doesn't look too good for us when the government chooses the arbitrator. So that's, for us, I believe, the one of the worst aspects of the bill.
Is there a set date for when the arbitration will happen?
It was supposed to be 90 days. We have 90 days to put forward our offer, as does the Canada Post, so at the end of, I guess, 3 months, at the end of September.
Is there anything about this unfortunate situation that I may have missed that you think is important for people to know?
I think that during the period of the rotational strike and right through the period of the lockout, we had tremendous support from the public, particularly on the picket lines directly, you know, people coming up, and I'd encourage people to continue to contact their MPs and tell them how disturbed they are that this took place. After all, that's what the external workers are hearing when they're delivering the mail, that they're quite appalled at this display of anti-democratic legislation.
So there is still a chance, albeit slim, that the postal workers can have a chance at a nice democratic bargaining agreement.
I'm hopeful. Yes, there is still a chance.
Well, thanks a lot for speaking with us, Robert. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for calling back.
Robert Mulvin is the president for CUPW Vancouver, the union that represents postal workers who were recently forced back to work under federal legislation with Bill C-6. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lemelin.
All right, you're hearing us on CITR News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building here on UBC. Get right back into it. The BC Environment Minister today, Terry Lake, he released a report outlining the province's direction for short and long-term action to protect species that are at risk of being endangered. Now, according to Lake, the report makes 16 recommendations addressing legislative change, environmental management, as well as First Nations and public engagement. Now, the task force that made the report was made up of 10 members who are chosen according to a wide range of experience and expertise, ranging anywhere from environmental protection, mining, and even resource management. So the province is now going to study the report over the next several months, and they're going to deliver a formal response down the line. In the meantime, British Columbians are encouraged to comment on the task force report through the Ministry of Environment website. But not everyone's going to be pleased with the way BC is taking care of its endangered species. Although the thought process is there, the recommendations the report suggests seem a little vague, and it looks like a lengthy process to put this plan into action, time we might not have. The Wilderness Committee, along with EcoJustice and Sierra Club BC, are calling for the government to introduce actual law that would protect these species. Now, Gwen Barley is the policy director of the Wilderness Committee and was kind enough to speak to CITR News about the report. Thank you very much for joining us, Gwen. Appreciate it. So, prior to the Species at Risk Task Force report, what was BC doing to protect endangered species?
Very little. We just sort of have a patchwork quilt
of policies and voluntary recommendations that are doing almost nothing to protect species at risk in BC. And because of that approach, we have 1,900 species at risk, and that runs all the way from phantom orchids to endangered species like grizzly bears and Vancouver Island marmots. And so what we are hoping, you know, last year the government, they were feeling some pressure because people are upset with them that we have so many species at risk. And so they struck a task force, and the task force actually submitted the recommendations of the report to government around Christmas, and the government sat on it for 6 months, and then they released it today. I'm not sure why. And what the task force does a good job of is saying, you know, that there's a problem here, that species at risk are in crisis in British Columbia. They're threatened because of climate change and degradation to their ecosystems, and there's problems with the current conservation approaches. But what they don't do, and this is what we are hoping the Wilderness Committee and EcoJustice and Sierra Club BC, we are hoping that they would call for the government to introduce standalone endangered species legislation. And BC and Alberta are the only provinces in Canada with no such legislation. And we have species like the spotted owl that are very close to winking out because we have a government that won't take real action to protect these species.
So it sounds like the report did a fairly good job of identifying the needs of the endangered species, but did very little with regards to actually helping them and identifying and bringing in legislation that would sort of force us to take notice.
Yeah, it's like you have one thing at the Forest and Range Practices Act, which was gutted, those protections, which was gutted about 7 or 8 years ago. And then you have the Wildlife Act, and the Wildlife Act is actually a hunting act. And then you have, you know, a few things to do with protections under, you know, it's identified wildlife management strategy, but there's only 4 species that have been identified under that strategy. So you have a government that's really turned its back on species at risk, and the result is that today in 2011, we have 1,900 species at risk. And so everybody was aware, like it didn't matter what side of the spectrum that you're on, people were aware that the current approach to protect species at risk in BC simply wasn't working. And now what we wanted to see, and this is what we are hoping for from the task force, is not only to identify the problems that species at risk are facing in this province, but to come up with meaningful solutions that would actually have teeth and would be enforceable. And that's what the task force didn't do. And that's what the Wilderness Committee and EcoJustice and Sierra Club are calling on. We're calling on the government to step up to the plate and introduce meaningful standalone endangered species legislation that will protect habitat and be based on science. And without that, you're going to see the spotted owl wink out. We're down to just 6 spotted owls in the wild because the government still allows logging in its critical habitat. We have badgers in troubles. We have, you know, Vancouver Island marmots that are in trouble, bluebirds, bobolinks, you know, yellow-breasted chats, and the list goes on and on and on and on. And people in BC, the Wilderness Committee has done lots of polling on this, are strongly supportive of species at risk legislation, and they want to see effective legislation implemented now. And we don't have time. I mean, really what's happening right now, where species are being studied to death, and the government won't do what needs to be done, and that's introduce a law.
Specifically, what would the standalone legislation do?
Well, the standalone legislation, the most important thing that it would do is identify and then protect habitat that species need to be able to survive and recover on. And 84% of species in British Columbia, and indeed right across the world, are at risk because of the threat and the degradation of their habitat. So that's a number, that's an incredibly important thing. And then you'd want to, you know, just basic things like recognizing that biodiversity is essential to healthy ecosystems, so that what's good for spotted owls, what's good for killer whales, what's good for grizzly bears, is also good for humans, so that we rely, you know, grizzly bears forest is our forest. The ocean habitat of killer whales is our ocean. And we need to take proactive, meaningful steps to protect these ecosystems and protect the species that rely upon them. And so you'd also need to be incorporating global warming and the impact that's having on species into policy and planning. You'd want to have everything, you know, obviously based on science and have a clear distinction between science and socioeconomic impacts. include the precautionary principle, have meaningful consultation with First Nations governments, and have real community and citizen participation. And also, too, it needs to be transparent and accountable, and very importantly, be properly funded and enforced.
So it would essentially be legislation that would protect the habitat of endangered species from being developed and from exposing these creatures to pollution and stuff like that.
Yeah, and to give you an example, spotted owls are an owl that are just found in southwestern British Columbia. That's the only place that they're found in Canada. And about 100 years ago, you probably had about 500 pairs of spotted owls that were roaming that territory. And today, because of ongoing logging right in the critical habitat of the spotted owl, and they like old-growth forests, and those are the same forests that logging companies want to cut down, that we're down to just 6 spotted owls in the wild in British Columbia, and they're about ready to wink out. And we don't want to see that happen to other species at risk in BC, but what, you know, if we're to prevent that from happening, I mean, the spotted owl and their plight is really a cautionary tale that we, you know, species need, they need more than discretionary policies. They actually need a clear, concise law that will protect habitat and be based on science. And that's the first step that we need to take if we're serious, if this government is serious about recovering species at risk.
And the other provinces in the country already have these laws in place.
Yeah, all the other provinces in BC have the legislation with the exception of Alberta. So Alberta and BC are the bad boys on the block when it comes to species at risk protection in Canada.
The government's press release almost made it seem as though this report put us on the forefront of protecting endangered species.
Oh, no, we are not at all. We're back of the pack. We're laggards. We're just dragging our heels when it comes to doing what needs to be done. That the government, it appears to me that the government doesn't want to step on the toes of mining companies and logging companies, and so they're letting species at risk fall between the cracks, and we're starting to lose species. Like, we've already lost the Dawson's caribou, and I think the western pond turtle, and, you know, and spotted owl is going to be next. And people value grizzly bears, and they value killer whales, and they value Vancouver Island marmots, and that they know, but they can't rely on goodwill alone, that they need effective legislation in place. And we've just called for this repeatedly. If the government is serious, if they're doing more than paying lip service to protecting species at risk in BC, the first thing that they would do was introduce an endangered species law.
So the report's out. What happens now with regards to the way the province deals with this?
Well, it'll be interesting to see how the government reacts to the report, but I know what the Wilderness Committee will be doing, and EcoJustice and Sierra Club, that will be continuing to educate people about the fact that BC doesn't have endangered species legislation, and will be continuing to call on the government to do the right thing and introduce the law.
I'm sorry, just as a quick aside, how long ago did you say we had 500 spotted owls in southern BC?
About 100 years ago.
100, and there's 6 now. Percentage-wise, that's fairly massive.
Oh, it's just a massive, massive radical drop. And what's so surprising is that you have the government's own logging program that's one of the key loggers in spotted owl habitat, and the fact that they're still allowing logging in critical spotted owl habitat when we're down to just 6 owls in the wild is just crazy. But I think it's also reflective of how this government approaches species at risk.
The government got going on this report about 2 years ago, didn't it?
No, it was a year and a bit. I think it was last September or last August when it was struck. And I'm pretty sure it was struck in 2010, and then we anticipated that once the task force released the report to government, and that was around Christmas, that the government would turn around and release the report publicly, and that didn't happen. They sat on it for 6 months, and then they finally released it today. So I think actually it was June 2010 that the government struck the Species at Risk Task Force.
Is there an outlet where people can go and voice their opinion, get in touch with government?
Yes, there is. If you go to gov.bc.ca, that the government's actually inviting comments from the public on the Species at Risk Task Force, and so you'll see on the gov.bc.ca website that there's a link on the first page to the press release that the government put out today, and then you can click through and you can go and read the report, and also you have the opportunity to make comment.
Do you have any hopes for when the wheels can really start turning on this?
Well, people can evidently, you know, they can make comments today, and I think that's a good thing. But this government knows what needs to be done. Like, it's not a mystery. It's not rocket science what species at risk need. What the government needs is political will to do it. And, you know, I'm an optimist, and I believe in 5 years or hopefully 3 years or even 2 years that we will have standalone endangered species legislation. But this government needs to step up to the plate and do the right thing.
You know, hopefully the spotted owls will still be around by then.
Yeah, knock on wood. I mean, if in a worst-case scenario, that they probably will wink out, but their habitat is home to 25 other species at risk, and they could always be reintroduced, but you just can't reintroduce baby spotted owls into clear cuts.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me, Gwen. Appreciate it.
No problem.
Have a nice day.
Thanks again.
That was Gwen Barley, Policy Director of the Wilderness Committee, an environmental group that's calling on the BC government to introduce legislation that would help protect species that are at risk of being endangered. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lumlin. In a minute here, we're going to have your weekly weather forecast. You're listening to CITR News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
Just fucking use you. You know what I'm saying, Joe?
What is that? What is it? One more shot? A salute?
Tune in to Sore Throats and Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday evenings at 6:30 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love.
Welcome back to CITR News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building here at UBC. And it's now time for your favorite part of the day, when you get a little break from listening to my voice, for the wonderful weather forecast of Jesse Storm. Jesse, what have we got going on here today? How are you doing, Jess?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Martin? How can I not be great? Do you see the sun outside right now?
I don't, but I'll take your word for it.
It is a beautiful day. Actually, Van City, there's an accident going eastbound at the Kingsway just before Boundary, and it's blocking the curb in right lane there. So expect delays going that way. Highway 1 westbound, the Portman Bridge is backed right up to 232nd Avenue, and heading northbound on 152nd is blocked all the way to 100th. Abbotsford and Mount Lehman Road at Simpson Avenue, an accident there is slowing traffic right down while they try to clear things up. And in the weather, well, in this magnificent city is nothing but sun for the next few days. We're sitting at 22 right now. We're expecting a low of 12 tonight. The clouds are not coming back again to play until later in the week. But tomorrow and Tuesday, it's going to be 23 degrees and a low of 14. So keep on smiling and keep those shorts out, that's for sure.
Hey, Jesse, do any of those traffic accidents affect the 99B line?
They do not, actually.
I don't think anybody cares then.
All right. Well, I know you wouldn't, Martin.
Of course not. All right. Thanks a lot, Jesse.
No problem, Martin. Have a great day.
Bye. All right. Back at her here. Good news for Romana Monzor. Now, there's a small glimmer of light for the UBC student who lost her eyesight last month. Romana Monzor left Dakar today. She's on her way to Vancouver, where local doctors and surgeons have agreed to operate on her eyes. Romana, a post-grad student here at UBC, lost her eyesight after her husband, Hassan Saheed Suman, attacked her and pushed his fingers into her eye sockets on June 5th. Now, Romana was taken to India for treatment, but returned to Bangladesh recently after doctors told her that they didn't have any treatment available for her. UBC, in the meantime, was asking for test reports in an attempt to see if they could do anything. And David Maberly, an ophthalmologist for Vancouver Hospital and Health Science Center, has agreed to conduct surgery on Romana's eyes. Since the possibility of recovering Monzor's eyesight is diminishing with time, Romana didn't hesitate to hop on a 2 a.m. Dragonair flight this morning. Now, I spoke with a friend of Romana's last week, shortly after he and other students organized a rally for justice in her honor. Mohsen Sadiq was kind enough to give us a bit of insight as to what Romana Monzor was like as he remembers her. joined by a friend of Rumana Manzoor. Lived with her in the community of the St. John's College dormitories. His name is Mohsen Sadiq. Thanks for joining me, Mohsen. How did the rally go yesterday?
Pretty good. We had quite a few hundred people attending, and we had messages coming from the president of the University of UBC, and then we had messages read by the acting principal of the college where she lived. So it's been a good rally. We received a lot of support from people attending, and it was good.
Now, it wasn't actually a fundraiser, was it? It was a rally meant to provoke thought that this sort of problem is happening all over the world, right?
Well, it was a rally for Rumana in the first place, and also a broader message to the public that we denounce violence against women, because Rumana is a victim of that bigger phenomenon, which is violence against women. So, yeah, it was not a fundraiser, and we did not collect funds, but we provided the participants with flyers, which directed them on how to actually take further action, either by donating or by contacting Bangladeshi officials and demanding justice for Rumana.
And you're actually encouraging people to contact the Bangladeshi. It's not the consulate in Ottawa, is it?
It is the Bangladesh High Commission in Ottawa, yes.
And you feel that if enough people phone and express their desire to see justice with regards to this particular case, that it'll make a difference?
Well, if they receive a lot of letters and people, a lot of phone calls from people demanding, it definitely makes a difference. I mean, they're going to receive reports from their officials here in Ottawa, and then. What happens that it is better than doing nothing. This is just like one of the things that can be done. We cannot guarantee that it will work, but this is one of the things that can be done.
The president of UBC, has he actually spoken to Rumana?
He sent a message. I don't know if he got to speak with Rumana or not, but he sent a message. He's been very supportive. He sent several messages, and the last one was read out at the rally by Rumana's academic supervisor, Peter DeVerne. It was a very supportive and very, very, very heartening and encouraging message for all of us, and also for Rumana. And I'm sure Rumana appreciates that.
What did the message say?
Well, the message is available online. It's at www.ubc.ca/helpRumana. But in general terms, what he spoke about was mainly he denounced domestic violence against women, and he also expressed his full support for Rumana if she decides to come back and finish her degree here, or whatever she decides with regard to her education. He was very supportive in his message.
As far as my understanding, the funds that are being collected by UBC from now until the 30th, those are meant to help ease the burden of the treatment costs, right?
Yes, that's true. She's going to need quite a large amount of money for her treatment. It's not going to be easy. And especially if she moves here for treatment, it's going to be even more expensive than I assume than it is already in Bangladesh and India. So, yeah, we've been trying to collect funds and do whatever we can to help her with her treatment.
Do you know if there's a chance that she'll be healthy enough to travel anytime in the near future?
Well, her family say that they are willing to travel to Canada or the United States if they've sent Rumana's medical reports to be shown to specialists here. And they say if any of these specialists say that they can do something about it, they will definitely fly out here. So I do not think that would be a huge problem, since they have already said that they are willing, because the eye, recovering the eye, at least the one eye, which is, there's very little hope, I think, but the one eye that might be recovered, if they can do that, I'm sure they would take her here, fly her here, and for the treatment that she might receive here.
And hopefully some of the medical professors here will be able to lend a hand.
Absolutely. We've been contacting specialists and other friends. Everybody's been doing that. And if anyone says that they can do something about it, they'll definitely let the family know, put them in contact, and they will make the decision probably to bring her here.
And you used to live with Romana at the St. John's College, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Were you guys mostly together when you found out? I mean, I'd imagine it would be fairly traumatic news to learn.
Yes, it was traumatic. It was not like someone told us, yeah, have you heard something happened to Romana? It came out of the blue, because the link to the video on YouTube, which was an interview she'd done, it was her first interview with local media about what happened. She was crying, she was blinded and disfigured. I'm sure it was traumatic for a lot of us here, because your friends, she'd left like three weeks before this thing happened. So it was a massive shock. It really was difficult for all of us.
What was it like when the students realized that they could help and wanted to? Was it something that happened right away, or did it sort of wait? Did you have to wait for the shock to wear off a bit?
Well, the first day we do things through meetings here. It's just like a very, very solid community, and we make decisions collectively, especially this kind of decision. So we got together, and I think the first meeting everybody was kind of shocked. A lot of people had been crying, and then we just discussed some options, such as setting up a Facebook page, and then, I don't know, creating some sort of online petition, sending her messages, more personal things, and some of the public. And it took a couple of days for us to get together again, and we decided on the idea of holding a rally. And that's how these ideas all came about. They came up, and we took some of them, we decided to go with some of them, and left some others, and so it's just like, everybody here did whatever they could, I think, to help.
What was Romana like on a day-to-day basis when you were living with her?
She is a very kind and sweet person. I don't remember seeing her without her smile around me. It was just like with everyone. She was very warm and very friendly. She loved cooking. She always talked about her daughter. And she always spoke with her daughter for 1 or 1.5 hours. I saw her quite often on the phone speaking to her daughter. And she was a family-oriented, and she loved her person, and she loved her education, and she tried real hard, and she was very hopeful about the future. She wanted to do a PhD, and she had a lot of plans. She was some sort of a person with a lot of plans for the future. She was full of hope, which I hope will continue. I mean, in this state, it's going to be very hard for her, but if she keeps up that spirit, it's going to be a lot of help to herself to get through this.
She was studying political science, right?
Yes, she was doing, she was in the political science department here, but she was mainly in international relations, and she was focusing on the question of climate change and the political aspect of it.
Do you have any idea what sort of uphill battle she's facing now? Not just regards to recovery, but either staying in Bangladesh or making her way over here with her family?
No one really knows that. She has to come out of the state, and the trial will have to go through. Hopefully justice will be served, and then she'll get used to not saying things. And then hopefully she'll be able to make a decision about her life. She has, on several occasions, even in the letter that I read out to the rally, which is the last letter that we have from her, she expressed her desire and her hope that she will be able to finish her degree here, because not much is left of. She's done all the coursework, and she's been working on her thesis. So what she had to do is just to finish her thesis, and hopefully she'll receive. She'll receive support from the community here at UBC, and be able to finish. But apart from that, that is something very, very difficult to guess. It's her life. And what we've been doing is just like, she's our friend, she's a member of this community, she's a member of UBC, and we will give her all the support that she wants.
Thanks a lot for speaking to us, Mohsen.
Oh, you're very welcome. Have a good night.
That was Mohsen Sadiq, a friend and fellow housemate of Ramana Manzoor, who was brutally blinded by her husband in Dhaka in Bangladesh a few weeks ago. Luckily, Ramana is on a flight to Canada in a hopeful attempt to restore her eyesight. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lemlin. Like the man said, this is CITR News 101. It is 5:51. Our hour is nearly done. We're going to try a little something different this time to end it out, because it's not all murder and heartache and news. So we're going to dug up a couple of stories that are on the lighter side of the spectrum, I suppose. But you should keep in mind that we are a news show, and we do take these things very seriously. These have been thoroughly checked for accuracy, and I can assure you that they are indeed accurate. For the first one, an Ohio school teacher is being faced with some odd charges, to say the least. Stephanie Robinette pled not guilty to charges of domestic violence, disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, and assault in a Delaware County court on Monday of last week. Now, reports show that the 30-year-old got in a dispute with her husband at a banquet hall. Her husband was apparently struck by Robinette several times. Then she locked herself in a car. When the cops got there, she refused to get out, yelling profanities at the poor sheriff. Now, according to a news release, one of these verbal assaults centered around the fact that Steph is a breastfeeding mother, at which point she whipped out part of her chest and sprayed breast milk towards the deputies. Robinette pled not guilty to all five charges, stressing that she has no prior criminal record and takes these charges very seriously. But there's still a chance she could face additional charges, such as harassing a law enforcement officer with a bodily substance. I'm very serious about this. Investigators are now trying to find out if any of the deputies were hit with the breast milk. An inmate of the Chicago penal system claims that his civil rights are being violated. Kyle Richards has put in a handwritten lawsuit complaining that he's being subjected to cruel and unusual punishment because they won't let him have porn in his cell. The 21-year-old was charged with bank robbery in January after police followed a trail of snowy footprints and cash all the way to his apartment in Fraser, which is just north of Detroit. And now Richards is in Macomb County Jail, being denied requests for erotic material, which he claims subject him to a poor standards of living and sexual deprivation. Now, the Chicago Department of Corrections says that prisons do allow pornographic materials, but jails don't. The basic difference between a jail and a prison is that a prison is usually state-run, holding those who have been convicted and of crimes and are serving lengthy sentences, while jails are run by local governments and usually hold those who are awaiting trial or serve short sentences. Now, Kyle Richards pled guilty to robbery, and he's going to be sentenced on August 2nd. That will determine whether or not he will get his pornographic material later on in his sentencing. Stick around. We're going to be right back on News 101.
For 7 days in July, Vancouver will play host to another international gathering of sports enthusiasts as we host the North American Out Games. The Out Games will feature 18 different sports, from badminton to poker to hockey. The games will also include the Human Rights Conference, with workshops on diversity and an awards ceremony recognizing individuals and corporations that have influenced LGBTQ rights. Scheduled events during week-long games include a job fair, the Miss Gay and Lesbian Sports Association pageant, cultural activities, and the most amazing closing ceremonies you've ever laid witness to. The event will come to a close with a march of athletes in the world-famous 2011 Vancouver Pride Parade. Catch all the festivities, events, and parties at www.vancouver2011outgames.com. Listen to our live broadcast on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver, or check out our live stream at www.citr.ca and www.queerfmvancouver.com.
And that's our program for July 4th, 2011. Today's newscasts were brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share comments, get involved with the show, give us a hot news tip, please, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca, Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITR News. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at CITR.ca. For more news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I am Martin Lemlin from the entire news team here at CITR. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands right here at 6 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the Helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the Helpline is one of the many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The Helpline number is 604-696-4666 or contact us at aidsvancouver.org.
Ever thought about volunteering with Big Sisters? Maybe now is the time. Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland provides girls aged 7 to 17 with a champion, a mentor who's there to simply be their friend